What? It's my hand.
It's the way they seek affection with their neck and their head is so canine.
Oh my god, don't fall off.
Like the way my dog sort of nuzzles in and burrows in for affection.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm completely sold on condors.
They're the best, I keep saying. They are. There's nothing that's as good as a condor.
They're so friendly.
She's the one who used to wake up asleep and put her neck across my neck.
And then wake up and try to kill you. Bite me.
Well, the other thing she used to do, about 4:15 in the morning, she'd wake up and she'd want to play.
Mm-hmm.
And she was this size, but not fully hard down, so she didn't have all the feathers. And she'd grab you by an elbow or an ankle and just pull you out of bed. Which, when you've got 10 kilos of condor hanging off you, you've got to go. You can't not go.
She didn't give you a choice, did she?
No.
Hello and welcome back to Trees A Crowd. It's David Oakes here, and I will keep this intro as brief as I can because we have a particularly meaty episode for you today. Today's episode was recorded with Holly Kale and Adam Block of the Horstmann Trust, a charity that has existed for only a handful of years, but one that is primarily focused upon breeding and ultimately releasing back into the wild 4 species of endangered vultures. They are the bearded vulture, the Egyptian vulture, the hooded vulture, and the Andean condor, of which you've already heard Adam playing with. Now, 70% of vulture species are currently threatened with extinction. And so there is a massive push on worldwide to save the animals we have left, because as you will shortly hear, vultures play an unbelievably important role in our planet's ecosystem. But what makes the Horstmann Trust particularly interesting is that these birds aren't being bred in Egypt or the Andes or southern Asia, where these animals are in serious decline. No, these vultures are Welsh vultures. Adam and Holly are the custodians of around 70 birds, which were previously the private collection of a brilliantly eccentric Carmarthenshire-based German hotelier called Manfred Horstmann. So, without further ado, this is Trees A Crowd, and this is Holly Kale and Adam Block of the Horstmann Trust in Wales.
In the depth of the forest and all over, the pride of the greenwood there, o'er his branches the ivy her mantle threw, when the forest boughs were bare. Oh, the oak and the ivy, oh, the oak and the ivy, oh.
So what am I looking at? Where am I? And what are all these dead things?
So we're in the food room where we prepare everything for the vultures that we're about to go and feed.
Mm-hmm.
And we're surrounded by meat that we've thawed ready to feed. So you've got calf ribs, you've got rats here, also some calf necks, various bits and pieces. We try and replicate what we can to provide a balanced diet, but in a safe, you know, we know where it's come from and that it's safe to feed the birds. So there's a little bit of chopping and organising to do, then we can head out and meet some vultures.
Am I right in saying that all vultures aren't necessarily just meat eaters? Obviously, most people know that they're scavengers and that they eat.
The majority of them are obligate scavengers, mm-hmm. i.e.,
they only eat.
They are obliged to scavenge. They don't hunt. They don't necessarily catch things for themselves. But there's always exceptions to those rules, and some of them will take advantage of something small that's available, so they might eat small mammals or insects or what have you, particularly some of the smaller ones, so the hooded vultures, the Egyptian vultures, and then you have ones like the palm nut vulture, which gets its name from its habit of eating palm nuts. It's not the only thing that they eat, but it forms a large part of their diet, particularly for youngsters.
Do you feed palm nuts?
We don't. We have done occasionally, but they're not necessarily easy to come by in the UK, palm nuts. But the youngsters in the wild, it forms quite a large part of their diet because they're learning about other food supplies. And of course, if you're catching a vegetable, it doesn't run away. It's not. And palm nut vultures generally are more likely to try and hunt something. So they catch a lot of things like crayfish and crustaceans and bits and pieces, as well as being a scavenger.
Sure. What can I call you? What is a vulture specialist?
That's a good question. Probably a vulture specialist.
Not a volcanologist, that would be...
Volcanologist, no. Volcanoes.
What would you like to be?
Now, there's a question.
I don't know. You're it's ornithology, I guess, to a degree, but it's sort of, I guess we're...
A lot of ornithology doesn't have butchery as a necessity.
Well, you know, we just happen to have things that eat mates. But back on your point, some of the birds also eat quite a lot of vegetation. Condors, about 20% of the diet can be vegetation because they're eating animals that have eaten vegetable matter.
Sure. So they get the stomach.
Because they're cavity feeders, they eat the stomach contents and the... grass matter, etc., that whatever they've decided to eat is now going to eat. I'm going to have to make a little bit of noise.
No, do some chopping.
Just because I can't get through that with a knife. The sound of someone
chopping cutting meat. A young cow.
Well, it's this is surplus from the human food chain. So most food is probably based on waste from what we'd eat as a human.
Sure. There's enough meat on those ribs, though, that you could whack them on the barbecue out front.
Well, these are actually human food.
These are actually human ribs.
Yeah, we've been out shopping. No, it's if we didn't use them for vultures, it would be human quality meat. We have exactly the same problems with drugs and things for the birds that humans face. So to make sure that we're not accidentally poisoning our animals, we use human grade food.
One of the problems with birds in the wild is lead poisoning.
Yeah, so none of the food that we feed has been shot. It's all dispatched. And as you may or not be aware with the problem with the vultures in Asia, which saw a 99.9% population reduction, that came from, majoritively, feeding beef that contained a drug.
Diclofenac.
Yeah, it's an NSAID, very common in human medicine, used in products such as Voltarol.
So is it a painkiller? Well, what does it do?
It's an anti-inflammatory.
Okay.
Very effective, works very well, and was licensed for use in cattle in Asia back in the 80s. Uh-huh. Turned out, unfortunately, it's fatal for vultures. So one dosage of diclofenac will cause death in a vulture in about 36 hours.
Crikey. And you said it was 90% of the vulture population in Asia, well, South Asia.
99.9%.
99.9%. That's a bit more than 90.
Yeah, it's a little bit more.
It's a worrying amount more than 90.
It's one of those populations, though, that was never counted because there were so many vultures. Yeah. It's a bit like the black kites or species that we just have so many of. Everyone just walks around going, we don't need to worry about those. So when they went, we're making a guess that there were somewhere between 40 and 80 million birds, potentially. So we're now facing massively reduced numbers of vultures out there.
Was this one particular species? Is this Egyptian vultures? Is this...
No, this was all of the Asian vultures. So slenderbills, longbills, oriental whitebacks. I think the Himalayans probably were affected to a degree.
Red-headed vultures.
So I guess now the question is, what vultures do you have on site? And I know you specialise in particular in trying to breed and release four species, primarily.
Yes, we've got eight different species of vultures here. But the bulk, the larger numbers that we have are hooded vultures, Egyptian vultures, bearded vultures, and then the Andean condors were sort of one of our core species as well.
So three of those are what you would call an old world vulture?
Yeah.
So from the old world in terms of Africa, Europe,
yes,
etc. Yeah. And then the Andean condor, clues in the title, New World, Andes, etc. Here's a nice popular science question. What's the nicest, sweetest, cutest, most interesting, idiosyncratic fact about each of those four species? Okay, bearded vultures.
Hooded vultures. Okay, Egyptian vultures. Egyptian vultures have been closely related to humans for quite a long time. So facts like they were the first vulture species, in fact, first bird species to ever be offered protection, dating back to the pharaohs.
There was an ancient Egyptian goddess called Nekhbet, who was associated with matriarchies and motherhood.
And the pharaohs offered protection so that if anyone did anything nasty to an Egyptian vulture, they'd do something nasty to the person, I suspect.
Yeah. I mean, they were good at doing that, burying a lot of them. So it's interesting, as we're on folklore, I went back and had a little dig to see what I could find out about vultures and folklore. And you obviously have the motherhood Egyptian god. There's an Indian folklore about a generous yet naive vulture who gets framed by a cat who ate a load of birds and blamed it on the vulture. There's a Nigerian folklore about a vulture who brought rain to the desert after a long drought. There's a Hopi Indian tale where a vulture creates the mountains and brings light to the world. And then obviously you've got Disney catching up with the Jungle Book's happy, friendly, we're your friends, vultures. Weirdly, folklorically speaking, vultures a pretty happy, nice, great thing.
They're always positive. The negativity seems to come in the sort of 19th century.
Yeah.
And actually, Disney didn't really help very much with the Jungle Book. You went from being positive, cleaning up, light. There's an Indian goddess who was saved by a vulture. Mm-hmm. To now we see them as vultures. They feed on dead things. They're a negative. And it's something that's portrayed a lot in media, etc.
You say that whilst you're cutting up a cow's rib cage. Do you think there's also a reason why we've sort of, as we have become more sanitised as a race, we've therefore become disassociated from gore, blood, scavenging to survive?
I suspect a lot of people think that beef comes from a plastic packet with cling film. We've put them onto the things that we universally despise, such as bankers. And I'm not saying everyone hates bankers, but it's a...
The Horseman Trust hates bankers, yeah. You heard it here first.
It's, you know, you're seeing politicians, people who get vilified in the press quite often are seen as vultures. For some reason, there seems to be something negative about cleaning up. Mm-hmm. We're dealing with the things that people don't want to deal with as a vulture. 80% of the meat in the environment in Africa isn't consumed by your big cats or hyenas or something. It's taken out of the environment by the vultures. Sure. So without the vultures, we suddenly don't have anybody taking the pathogens and all the badness.
I was reading about, I think it was an Indian community, whereby they get rid of their human bodies by placing them on a pile where the vultures take them, because they believe that burial or cremation is disrespectful to the human being, and it's about transcendence. It's about offering up your... I mean, I don't think they actively do it to let the vultures take them away. It's the disappearance that nature consumes them. And
your Parsi Indians believe that that they should be consumed by the vultures and taken away. Burning's wrong, burying is wrong, and unfortunately none of those practices can now take place. There are no longer enough vultures to actually
get rid of the people.
In fact, one of the places that vultures disappearing was first noted was Mumbai.
The Towers of Silence in Mumbai.
They realised that the bodies weren't disappearing. And what was happening is the kites were coming in and trying to do the same job. Because if you create a vacuum, something else will try and fill the vacuum. But they're not adapted to do the same job. So,
in terms of they didn't have the talons or the beaks, or they didn't have the digestive enzymes to break down
everything.
The diseases
and meat. Yeah, they've got very small feet. They haven't got big beaks to tear things apart.
And there simply isn't the biomass of them either. We mentioned before about the population of vultures, particularly in that part of Asia.
Sure.
There were an awful, awful lot of vultures, and they would sit at the Towers of Silence knowing that this is somewhere that bodies would be presented for them. Mm. And their biomass was there that they would strip a carcass in minutes. And kites just can't do that. They're much, much smaller. They don't consume that volume of meat in that time frame. They're not designed to do it.
They're also a snatch lifter, so they tend to come in, grab a piece of food and fly off with it.
Take it away, whereas the vulture stays.
So if you come in and grab something from a Tower of Silence and fly off with it and accidentally drop it...
You've dropped a human hand on a population.
Well, they went maybe a finger. A hand's probably a bit heavy for a kite. But yeah, there is a problem that the kites did then produce. Doing sky burials is also in Nepal. It used to happen in Iran. It's something that's been quite widely done because it gets rid of disease, it gets rid of bodies. Vultures have the capacity to neutralize, they're an end stop for pathogens. So if you give something to a vulture that contains botulism, plague, rabies, it doesn't go any further. If you give it to a lion or something else, it goes through and ends up in the ground.
Yeah.
So they're very important as an end stop for most of these pathogens.
Do you think Manfred Horseman, who obviously had this collection before it became a trust and NGO, do you think he ever considered saying goodbye to the living plane through a sky burial with his own vulture collection? A secondary question, do you think as a way for the trust to raise money in the future, do you think you could offer a unique burial service to your most diehard supporters and fans?
It's one of those questions we get asked quite a lot, actually, and it's a conversation...
There's me hoping it's an original.
No, it's one of those ones that, not for offering as a commercial service, but it's one of those questions people ask about sky burials. The problem is we use drugs in humans. There are very few people who would sit there.
The diclofenac that's going to be in your Voltarol is going to get.
Don't give me any painkillers. Don't give me any painkillers.
Yeah.
So we have to bear that in mind as a minimum problem.
So okay, say you're an anti-vaxxer and a pharmacy denier.
No, not at all.
Only having organic natural remedies, then maybe you can come here and say goodbye to the world with the bearded vultures.
The problem is, would we trust them? The birds are the most important thing. We like the food we provide. Everything is traceable. Yeah. We know the full history. We don't feed things which we could probably get for nothing because of the potential risk. The genetics and the birds available now are diminishing so quickly that we're in a race to try and stabilise the populations we have to make sure that genetically we can keep breeding for the future and provide birds for release back into the wild.
Sure. Going back to the birds that you want to release to the wild, that was the cute cuddly fact about Egyptian vultures. Give me a bearded vulture fact, please, Holly.
Bearded vultures are the only bird, I think, not just only vulture, but only bird, that is so highly specialised with its diet, it consumes 90% bone. It is a specialist feeder. So
breaks down the bone or just takes the marrow? Or
breaks down the bone.
Oh, wow.
And it sounds very counterintuitive to meat eaters that, you know, we're used to understanding the value of muscle and protein and things like that. But they are highly specialised. They are physiologically quite different to the other vultures. They don't have a crop, which is where their food goes into this sort of elastic, expandable pouch where they can gorge themselves and then pass their food down through their digestive system quicker. So you'll see that with some of the other birds. They have a crop that they just fill with food.
Sure.
Bearded vultures don't have that. Their food goes straight down into a very acidic stomach and they're able to digest literally big chunks of bone. And the nutritional value from those chunks of bone is actually as good as the meat and the things that we would traditionally think of as rich food.
I'm fascinated to hear how this conversation about digesting bone is going to come across whilst you cut a rat in half.
I'm not cutting it in half, I'm just skinning it.
Just skinning it. Sorry, just to give people context of what the noise in the background might be.
So what you have is a bird who, as part of the food web and the chain of, you know, the ecosystem, will come to a carcass last. So the other vultures or other scavengers or, you know, predators that have eaten the meat from that carcass leave behind the bones because they're not equipped to digest them. And the bearded vulture comes along and tidies up the rest.
So do the bearded vultures therefore live sort of almost in coexistence with another vulture species as well? One would imagine that there would have to be something else to get rid of the diseases as well, as we're talking about them as a good end stop.
Yeah, all of the vulture species come from areas where there's lots of other predators and scavengers. So there are, you know, parts of the world where there are wolves and there are bears and there are, you know, these other species alongside other vulture species as well. One of the things that we have in Europe is that our landscape has been so highly changed over the years and our sort of populations of different animals and the ranges that they've been moved out of or restricted to through persecution or hunting or whatever it might be, human activities, has meant that it's not as it would have been hundreds of years ago. So they're quite fragmented populations, some of these. The bearded vultures in particular are, you know, in particular spots where the conservation work has been done, particularly on the western part of Europe, to try and link them back up. So give them that sort of link between those different populations and a bit more movement of the birds across.
Like bearded vultures, therefore, it's as much of a success story as one could hope for at the moment if there's a good conservation effort trying to join up these extant populations.
Yes, yeah. I mean, the bearded vulture program is very extensive in where they're putting them. What they're, you know, it's very well organised in terms of trying to find the best places to reintroduce them or to bolster populations that are already there.
Sure.
And they've gone from very small numbers slowly creeping up to two larger numbers, but it's not as it would have been hundreds of years ago just yet.
You do get cooperation as well between vultures. Mm-hmm. So in America, South America, sorry, turkey vultures and king vultures will work together. If a turkey vulture finds a dead tapir, the turkey vulture can't open up the tapir because its beak just isn't big enough for the job.
Sure.
So they'll actually go off and find a king vulture and annoy the king vulture until the king vulture follows them back to the tapir. And then the king vulture will do the opening up and everything and then make it possible for the turkey vultures to eat.
That's cool. We're talking about vultures in terms of New World and Old World simultaneously. I guess it's important to state that they have evolved completely independently of each other. Is there a difference between the two fundamentally? Is it just appearance that they look the same?
They're a fantastic example of convergent evolution, so mm-hmm. where two things have had a separate origin and separate sort of common ancestor.
Sure.
But as they've evolved, the habits of obligate scavenging and what the requirements are for them physically to be able to do that, they have ended up looking very, very similar.
Sure.
So lots of similarities, you know, smaller or fewer feathers on their head. Very few vultures are actually completely bald. They all have very soft, very tiny
From my initial feathers. Walk around yesterday, they're all looking rather wonderful. It's none of that sort of bald-headed sort of tonsure-wearing monk attitude.
Exactly, but they're put together to do a job, so they don't have, you know, big fluffy heads like owls do because mm-hmm. they're diving in and out of a carcass and they want to
you don't want to get goop on your hair,
clean.
Do you?
Yeah, exactly. So you need to be able to keep yourself clean. So they've ended up, you know, converging in the way that they look and how they behave and what they do, but sort of from their origins, they are quite different. There's certain things that you don't get similar across the two, Old World and New World. So the Old World vultures came from a bird of prey, an eagle lineage. So they have bigger rear talons and still big, fairly powerful feet, although they don't really use them. They don't use them for attacking anything or killing anything, but there's still some power in there. The New World vultures have come from a stork. I'm looking at Adam here.
Every time people do work on things, everything gets moved around a little bit because the genetics show something slightly different. So if you look at birds generally, where they fit in the family tree changes.
You were showing me the feet of the Andean condor yesterday and suggesting that they're sort of more goose or duck or...
Yeah, if you look at the condor and look at its head, the head shape, if you put a duck or a goose beak onto it, the head shape generally is very like a goose or a duck or a swan. If you look at the feet are much more like that of a waterfowl. Mm-hmm. It has a residual rear toe, so it has a toe that doesn't really function like on a bird of prey. It doesn't have the big hallux, there's no real big power. Actually, they use it a lot. It's a very important toe for them when they're sitting on the side of something, they hook on with it.
Okay.
But it's almost passive. It's just a toe that sort of is there to stabilise.
If they didn't have it, would that be a problem?
It would definitely hinder in feeding if you're on a carcass or something. Uh-huh. I don't think it would be...
existential.
No, it's not going to cause the mortality of the animal.
Would that not be the case for New World vultures if they lost their rear talons?
New World vultures. The condors. On the condors, I don't think it would cause a big problem. On the Old World vultures, so your proper big vultures, it's definitely more of a problem. On the ground...
I hope you don't say to your condor that they're proper big vultures. I'm sure the condor would have a bit of a...
When you're dealing the real vultures, the true vultures.
So the condor's still getting upset now.
Well, the condor is a condor. It's not a It's part of the New World vultures. But if you're talking about the vultures everybody expects to see when they think of vultures, that's your griffin vultures. So that includes your white backs, your cape vultures, your Himalayans. That's the iconic vulture. Mm-hmm. That's the one. Interestingly, everyone thinks, as you said earlier, bald headed. But actually, I'm yet to meet a bald-headed vulture. Every vulture has feathers on its head. It's just they're very, very fine. Stroking a vulture's head is a bit like stroking velvet. They're incredibly smooth. Presumably, the smoother it is, the easier it is to get the whatever it is you've stuck on your head off.
He says cutting off the rear end of a rat.
Lunch. turkey vultures... Psychologically, personality-wise, the New World vultures are very different to the Old World vultures as well. They're more complex, I would say. Though people will probably argue with me about that and say that...
It's worth saying that you have a sympathy for condors in particular and New World in general. Is that fair to say?
Yes, I'm slightly biased.
You as an
Adam,
not you as an horseman trust.
Yeah, no, me as an individual. I think that the New World birds are... probably psychologically closer towards things like corvids and the way they problem solve and they deal with things. And it's not true of all of them. Turkey vultures are simpler than condors. King vultures are very intelligent. Mm-hmm. Condors are very intelligent. And that's not to say that Old World vultures aren't intelligent. It's just different. It's the way they project it, the way you see it, the way they seem using it. It's like an owl. An owl is a highly intelligent...
They're quite precise.
...but very adapted for a single purpose. Whereas I think the Old World birds are probably a little bit more generalists.
Everyone's aware that crows, lots of corvids, are particularly intelligent in problem-solving. Would you put vultures in that same category?
Not all of them. Condors, definitely. Lots of problem solving. Learn visually. But again, as you become more focused on what you do and the way you do something, you've got a single method of eating or looking for food. You don't need the generalizations. Mm-hmm. You become very, very focused. Falcons, very good at what they do. Not the most playful thing in the world, because they don't have to. They're very, when they're babies and they're learning, incredibly playful. You get a baby gerfalcon, they'll play fetch. Mm-hmm. But as a grown-up, it's very, very focused on one job. And they do it very, very well.
Here's a bit of a left-field question. You can obviously interbreed different, few different species of hawks and falcons to get hybrids.
Yeah.
Do you call them a hybrid?
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you do that with vultures?
It does happen. Yeah. It's there are, in fact, some in the wild that have hybridized. Uh-huh. The gyps vultures in particular, they're all very close together.
Okay.
And the thing that really defines them as species is, you know, of course they vary in size slightly and they vary in coloration and what have you. But that separation is largely geographical. Mm-hmm. So, you know, your Cape vultures come from the furthest, you know, down in southern Africa. White-back vultures, a bit more widespread, go, their range stretches a little bit further. The Rupel's vulture then comes from sort of central Africa, sub-Saharan, but central Africa.
Okay.
And so the gyps species are all very similar, very close together on the taxonomic tree. And a hybridization between those species can and will happen.
Okay.
But not necessarily to any great extent until you find yourself in a position where, you know, you might get a Rupel's white-back hybrid because there are fewer birds to choose from in the area that you're in. So
they fill the gap by bringing in another species.
They fill the gap by pairing up. As I say, it's incredibly rare, but it does happen. And they do produce perfectly viable and healthy chicks from that. So
sterile, or could they?
I don't believe so.
No, I believe they. I think one of the key things here is this is becoming more common.
As we're having an effect on population.
Yeah, partially it's because people weren't very interested in vultures. Uh-huh. Vultures being cool is quite a new thing. It's as they disappear, they become cooler. Historically, there were a few hybrids in zoos because you'd managed to get a white back and you managed to get a cape or rappels. You'd chuck them in the same aviary and they've accidentally bred and you've now got a
They're in an aviary and they've got nothing to do, so they might as well.
Yeah.
Oh, boys will be boys, girls will be girls.
Exactly. You know. But we are now seeing them in the wild, as Holly said. And the suspicion is that it's happening particularly with rappels at the moment. And the suspicion is that as the numbers get increasingly low, they just cannot find a partner. And the imperative to breed is still there, but they're just not.
The other thing that's happening with the rappels, specifically, as we've come on to rappels, is they're also moving north. So historically, they're not a European species, but there have been now, as they've come up
the climate's
sort of West
warming.
African flyway. Okay. Yeah, so they've come up the West Africa into North Africa and, you know, skipped over that straight into Southern Europe.
It's one of my favourite things about birds is that they will be the first and best suited to adapt to climate change because they can move better than land animals, certainly better than trees and plants. I mean, they will have to adapt in terms of finding a new food stuff because that will shift, but they have that first ability to get the fuck out of Dodge.
Yeah.
Well, you've got the same question at the moment with the long-eared owls.
Mm.
People are saying, oh, we need to do breed and release for long-eared owls. And I'm sort of thinking, well, they're not coming over. Why are they not coming over? Well, they're not probably coming over because it's not cold enough now in Scandinavia where they were from. So why bother making that dangerous flight over the North Sea to get to the UK to breed? There's definitely things changing.
Sure.
What's causing it is another conversation.
You seem to have finished cutting up bits of animal. So should we go and feed some?
We can go and feed some, yeah.
Wonderful. Let's head outside.
So this is a site that never gets boring. When you come to this aviary, and we've got in this aviary 14 hooded vultures and 3 cape vultures, they know when it's food time. So they all come up to this end. And then as we walk down to the door, which is about halfway down the nearly 100 metre long aviary, they fly alongside us.
Okay, I'm going to enjoy this then.
And you should hear them talking to us as well when they land, they start.
It's lovely that they've got a big enough aviary that they can actually fly along it. You've got a heron sitting on top of it.
He's gone.
There he goes. And you've got a peregrine flying above us. So if the vultures weren't enough bird life.
Here we go.
Here they go.
Here they come.
Wow. Why have you got these two species together?
Well, naturally, they would be found in the wild together.
So that's fine. That's your decision with this, is that they live together. And
yeah, and it adds a slight dynamic to the whole thing that having the big birds and the little birds together brings. So the birds which have the darker heads are the juveniles.
Mm-hmm.
The very grey-headed birds are the much older birds. And we have everything from 1 year to 27, 28 years old in here.
We're saying that as we entered there, we put our feet in a dip to get rid of potential contamination for avian flu. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah. So we take various biosecurity measures as best we can because we don't want to risk bringing something into the aviary.
Is avian a very real concern for you at the moment?
Yeah, it's a disease that's now become endemic in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Historically, it would have been a disease that would have occasionally appeared. But over the last few years, we really, Salem, we really don't get a break from it. There's a little bit of a break at the moment, but we're expecting as the migratory birds come back through that the numbers will still start increasing. It is one of our highest, you know,
worries.
Yeah, if you get avian influenza in a collection like this, you're potentially losing not insignificant percentages of the world's captive population.
So in here we've got the hooded vultures, which are one of your main four planned breed and release species. Is this a breeding aviary? Are they making nests up there? Are they getting ready to do the dirty?
So the construction of the aviary is one big long flight. As Holly said, it's around about 100 metres long. It's about 12, 14 metres wide at the narrowest. And off the back of it, we have about eight bays. Each of the bays has a nest ledge in it. And if you actually look at this bay here, we have a hoodie nest from last year. We don't take the nests out. We clean, we make sure there's not debris or things rotting in there. And you can see they build a stick nest.
Yeah.
There's always a favourite spot. So there's always a spot that everybody wants, and that's it in this aviary. It's near the bath, it's near the food.
Sure.
And then as you work down, they become progressively less popular. So this is the Knightsbridge, and then you keep going down this way. We are changing one or two things, and one of the things we will be doing is taking some of the breeding pairs out. What we found with hoodies, they're not a colony nester. They're not designed to live in big groups.
So they feel pressured nesting by a next door couple that are...
Next door want to move in.
Okay.
So there'll be sort of attempts at evictions and things occasionally. So we're moving the pairs that we know, apart from the primary pair they're staying in here, as we find the pairs, we're pulling them out and putting them into their own dedicated aviaries so they have their own space. Stress levels are much lower. Risk of losing eggs, etc., becomes less.
Are these all your hoodies, all 14 of them?
No, there's another four which we have in another aviary.
Okay. And how many eggs would you hope 2024 is going to bring through? They lay one egg per couple?
Yeah, they're a single egg layer.
Yeah.
We know that we have potentially four pairs. So there's two definitive pairs in this aviary and then a third pair who last year did do some nest building but weren't quite ready to lay. But we're hoping by bringing those out from the colony situation and putting them into an aviary that's individually for them.
Do they pair for life?
That's always an interesting question because, of course, it is the life of whichever dies first.
Yeah,
and then another one will come in.
They will find a new partner.
But there is competition for nests and competition for partners as well. So you've got to be fit and healthy and appealing to want to, you know, to appeal to your partner. So that, yes, they do pair for life within reason.
How do they attract a mate? Do they have a courtship dance? Do they puff up the feathers? Do they whack all the blood into their skin and eyes to make them glow like a luminous balloon?
You can see with the hoodies here in front of us as they're feeding, they're all varying shades of pink on their face. So they flush pink when they get excited.
Hence the food and therefore...
They send more blood to those capillaries by the surface of the skin. So you'll see an excitement sort of flushing happen. It happens when they're feeding. It also happens when they're fighting, if there's a bit of a argy-bargy going on. And it also happens when they're, you know, getting into courtship behaviours and things like that. The hoodies do a lot of preening each other. and sort of head turning and sidling up to one another in the aviary. So there's not an elaborate dance, but there's very subtle behavioural cues and courtship display where they're just sussing one another out quietly. They do this head turning and mirroring each other's behaviour a little bit as well. So,
Am I right in saying that 90% of vulture parts that are traded for superstitions, religions and that kind of thing are hooded vultures?
Yeah. It depends where you are in Africa and in the world. It's a big problem in Africa for the vulture species. But the thing about hooded vultures is they are smaller. They are a little bit easier to catch.
Okay.
They also hang around closer to humans. So recently, this year, I think there was an article published about a tree that was a very well-known roosting tree for hooded vultures in Sierra Leone, I think it was, that unfortunately, during a storm, got damaged. Uh-huh. Some of the boughs came down. I'm not sure the whole tree came down, but some of the boughs came down. And overnight, the hooded vultures, of course, were all nesting in there. They got blown out of the tree. They're all soaking wet from the storm.
Couldn't fly away.
And there was about 100 birds, and I think one of them got rescued.
Oh, God.
The rest, people managed to go and pick up to use for belief-based use or, you know, those activities that happen in that
They're
part of the
world. They're also eaten.
They do get eaten. Yeah,
yeah, there was a report recently from, again, Africa, where you can buy a bowl of hoodie stew for 80 cents.
Huh.
So it's part of the bushmeat trade. It is part of the mooty trade. Historically, heads have been very popular, heads and feet.
Sure.
So quite often if you find a dead vulture, its heads and feet are missing, parts have gone for trade. One of the beliefs behind some of it, because there are lots of different things they use for medicine, is if you smoke the brains of a vulture, you can foretell the future.
Huh.
So if you...
Is that true?
Of course.
Yeah, okay.
No. So if you introduce something to South Africa, like World Cup football,
mm-hmm.
or the national lottery, it has a detrimental effect to the vulture population.
Sure.
It's weird to think that a national lottery ticket in South Africa is actually costing the lives of vultures, but it's totally true.
Or Shakira's World Cup anthem from the 1990s.
We forget about how important these things are to people as well. So you'll probably go for your faith-based medicine before you go for your Western medicine. So that is a big threat. But interestingly, probably some of the other big threats are things like power lines.
They can't manoeuvre as quickly as other birds of prey, so I presume that...
They also put the power lines exactly in the places where they really don't help. So at the bottom of nest sites.
I mean, that's not deliberate.
No, they don't go, there's a vulture, we're going to put a power line here. It just happens that birds use flyways, and the flyways, coincidentally, things like wind turbines and power lines, happen to fall into the right geographical locations for some of these objects.
Uh-huh.
So if you get a nice flat piece of land at the base of a rift or something where you've got a cliff where the vultures happen to nest, you put out your power lines because it's cheaper and easier. Also, things like lead poisoning may play a part of this. So lead poisoning from shooting or agriculture, but industrial, potentially cause visual or sight problems for the vultures.
Okay.
So spotting things like power lines becomes a problem as well. So there's correlations between everything that we do that potentially impacts these guys.
It's worth saying that the Horseman Trust is a relatively new foundation. It's only existed for this year, I think, in official terms.
We're exactly a year old.
But you've had this collection of birds in some form has existed on location here for 40 years. So what is the history? Where have these birds come from?
There's a mixture here. Some of these birds, because of their age, will originally have been wild taken.
Mm-hmm.
No one was breeding vultures apart from this location 30, 40 years ago, because the interest wasn't there and the numbers were so high. And there was no reason you couldn't just go and buy yourself a vulture from Africa or wherever you wanted. You bought vultures. So the birds were purchased, and then 50% of this population were bred here from those original founding birds.
By a lovely German man called Manfred Horsman.
Indeed, who was very, very interested in vultures.
Do we know why?
No. I think it's one of those situations where somebody saw something, fell in love with it, and that became a very big driving force in his life. And, you know, we feel the same way about vultures. So completely understand that. It's not something we ever question, why do we love vultures? They're just incredible characters. We've worked with lots of species of birds. We've worked with everything from the smallest falcons and owls through to our condors. And somehow the vultures just get under your skin.
Sure.
They are just intelligent, they're bright, there's always something going on. You're never bored watching the vultures.
fight over the bit of rib.
It's a juvenile hoodie who's trying to steal something off a Cape vulture, which is 3-4 times its size. It's they're just the best. There's nothing you can really sort of pin down as one attribute. It's not because they are the most beautiful. Personally, I think they're incredibly beautiful. Other people would disagree. They don't have big ears and big eyes and sort of furry, but they are each one, especially things like lappet-faced vultures, they're just stunning if you get close to them and look at them.
There was breeding going on here under Manfred. Was that to breed and release, or was it just as a collector who wanted to see what would happen, like the joy of getting an egg and sort of releasing it into the world, into your aviary, but like...
There was no release when he started. Sure. There was no need to. If you had 40 plus million birds flying around, who would spend the time and money shipping a bird back to India or Europe? So that didn't really come in. He did release, he donated bearded vultures back to VCF for their breeding project. So there
was he careful in making sure that he wasn't inbreeding at all? Like, what kind of precautions was he making? I mean, there wasn't anyone overseeing.
You didn't know. It's it's a bit like anything that you bought in the old days. You were buying a box, and in that box you had
some bits of vultures.
The good thing about most vultures is, so if you were getting baby vultures or young vultures, the likelihood of them not being related is quite high. Being a single egg layer, you only get one egg a year.
Sure, of course.
So your chances are. The only problem with that argument is that you tend to go back to the same place to get the eggs the next year or the chicks next year because you're lazy, because you're doing it as a local for not very much money. We've just started doing the genetic studies on these guys. It's, we've just sequenced all of the hooded vultures and all of the Egyptian vultures here so that we can look at the coefficients and make sure that we're not compounding any problems that have existed. But birds do inbreed to a small degree anyway. The problem comes when you do it generation after generation after generation.
We'll talk about breeding in a bit, but I know that you hatch the eggs here and get them through the sort of the early stages before you release them. Is there any reason why you make sure you're sending birds and not eggs? Is there an argument that it could be easier to send warm eggs in the post rather than sending live animals by freight?
Transporting eggs is actually really quite difficult, depending on the stage of development of the egg. But the embryo inside an egg is very vulnerable and it needs very controlled conditions. So it needs a very set specific temperature that allows that embryo to develop normally and without issue. So if you're transporting eggs and you're moving them around, particularly if it's in the early stages, so in the first sort of third of incubation, as the embryo is developing, the cells that are getting organized into which body part they're going to become are fairly loosely adhered. So if you get jarring and shaking and, you know, vibration from transport, so it's in a car or a truck or something and the road vibration.
Or in a dodgy suitcase as you're trying to get through customs.
Exactly. It can cause an issue. It's not necessarily a guarantee that it'll be an issue, but it's actually much easier to move
a live bird,
even if it's a small chick, because the parameters don't have to be so tight. If it gets a little bit cool, that's fine. You can warm it back up again. If it gets a little bit too warm, you can cool it back down. So the incubation side of things, of course, in a nest in the wild, it would be laid in one location. It would stay in one location. In a nest here in this scenario, it is laid in the nest, it stays in that location until I bring it into the incubator room if it's going to be artificially incubated.
Yeah, so there's the question. If they lay one egg, under what conditions do you decide that you have to bring it into an incubator to artificially rear it?
One of the things that we take lots of things into consideration. One of the things we take into consideration is what's going on in the aviary, whether there is a little bit of pressure or a little bit of argy-bargy, that egg might accidentally become damaged.
Sure.
If another bird comes in towards the nest and the parents are trying to defend the nest, there's a likelihood that they could put a tiny pinprick hole, a talon hole in the egg, something like that. There's lots of little variables like that that can all play into it. And of course,
We're trying to optimise
what we have and what we're able to produce. And of course, we're in Wales, which is not quite the same climate as Africa, which is where these guys come from. So the humidity can be sort of suboptimal at times in Wales. Is that a politically correct way of putting it? It rains a lot.
I think that's as politically correct as you can say.
So sometimes you have to sort of look at it and say, well, there's a chance that the humidity's not quite right, and it's not that the birds aren't perfectly capable of doing their own incubation. Sometimes a little bit of a helping hand. And sometimes it's for our peace of mind that we know that we've done everything we can to hatch that egg.
Ultimately, really, you want every bird to raise its own chick, hatch its own egg, do the whole thing by itself, because we're not going to try and double clutch or produce more eggs than we have pairs for. We don't want to create imprints. If you're getting to a point where the population has dropped so much that you need any genetic material, that's when you start imprinting, or you start creche rearing.
And being able to artificially incubate gives you, in those worst case scenarios, the option to do what's called double clutching. So you take the first egg, but rather than leave a dummy egg for the birds to sit on, you leave the nest empty to encourage them to lay a second egg. So you can do those sorts of things. And in an ideal world, you don't get to that point, because you're simultaneously, while doing captive breeding programs, trying to solve the problems that have made the birds rare in the first place. So going through mitigation for all of the issues that have arisen. And when it comes to vultures, it's basically human activity in one form or another that's pushing them to that brink.
Of all of the four species that you're breeding and hoping to release, are you able to release all of them now, or are conditions on the ground where you would release them still not good enough in terms of trying to mitigate human destruction and the threats that vultures would face, so that you're breeding to create a population that will be needed eventually in order to release eventually?
My question is how
many of the species that you're breeding are you actually able to release at this point in time?
There are release programs for the bearded vultures and the Egyptian vultures, which are very successful in the places that they're happening. In the case of the hooded vultures, the IUCN guidelines, so there's a strict set of guidelines for how you identify whether or not it's safe to reintroduce an animal back into the environment, whether it's a mammal or a bird or whatever. And the IUCN criteria for releasing vultures in Africa isn't yet met. So the risks are still high. There's still, you know, secondary poisoning, tertiary poisoning, or primary poisoning rather, where you've got bait being put down to deliberately poison vultures, you've got power lines, you've got...
Yeah, there's one thing we haven't mentioned yet, is a lot of vultures die as a result of poachers trying to get rid of vultures to stop highlighting where the recent poaching activity took place, to stop them being caught, etc.
Or they've actually killed the elephants by, or whatever they're poaching, by poisoning, because they can't afford the gun that does it, so they go down the local store, buy a barrel of strychnine, roll it down to the water hole, drop it in the water hole. And then that doesn't just kill the elephant, but it kills anything that then feeds on the elephant or drinks from the water. Mm-hmm. So it's a very sort of crude and deliberate way of killing the elephant, but it also wipes out everything from lions, vultures, flies, insects, anything that comes in contact.
It's one of the interesting, everyone's talking about the sort of holistic nature of biodiversity at the moment, and I think people forget that also the causes of biodiversity loss is also an holistic loop that is being affected by multiple factors simultaneously that all have a knock-on.
So when it comes to the hooded vultures, for example, our primary goal is to maintain a stable population within a captive setting with the birds that we have, so that when those criteria are met, you know, at the point at which there are areas in Africa that all interested parties are happy and satisfied that it would be safe, the birds are available to do
to go
that.
Back. And in the interest of genetics and diversity, it is important, therefore, that there is a Welsh population of hooded vultures, because it is absurd that you're in Wales. Like, it's wonderful, but it's bonkers, right?
It is, yeah, slightly...
esoteric. It comes down to several things, and you'll notice there's a lot of breeding done in Wales, and it comes down to land prices. You're putting your money into the animals you're working with and setting up costs and everything else. So if you go and want to do this in the middle of Kensington or somewhere, it would be hugely expensive.
You can't build an aviary like this that gives them 100 metres to fly along.
The value of the land is so high.
Yeah.
Also trying to find places that are not disturbed by aircraft flying over and people walking and everything else. Trying to find key locations for this type of thing is actually quite difficult. So we're very lucky to have such a great piece of land. And, you know, the the generous donation by Brett of the site and the birds to the charity. And, you know, we are protecting their legacy, and hopefully we're giving a future for what will be a 100-year project plus. Some of the birds we have here live for up to 80 years.
That's the condors, right?
The condors, yeah, 70, 80 years. And as we understand birds and we look after birds, we're also getting better at it. So just like humans, they're living longer. So we have a care of duty for these animals, which goes on way beyond our personal working lifespans.
Sure.
So we're always having to think two or three generations ahead to make sure that there are people who will be carrying on this work.
Are we going anywhere else now?
We can go and feed someone else.
Let's go and feed someone else.
One of the things that you're particularly good at doing is incubating and raising and hatching things. I've got it down as you've hatched 50 species of raptor and 9 species of old world vulture. Is that still right?
Yes, I think so. It might be 10 species of vulture now.
Oh, congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
Was that Bernadette last year?
Yes, yeah. The first Eurasian black vulture to successfully be hatched in the UK.
Congratulations.
Which was a real achievement, least of all because the pair are a little bit of a mixed bag. The male is a bird called Bernard, who was originally imprinted. And so initially he spent a lot of time being very attached to humans, specifically me and a few other people that have worked with him over the years. So encouraging him to transfer his behaviours, where he would bring sticks and try and build a nest at my feet, to the female, who isn't an imprint. She's a parent-reared bird.
Uh-huh.
So initially she spent a lot of time looking at him going, what on earth is that idiot doing over there with that human? So to bring the two of them together, to get them to nest build with each other and get him to understand that all of those behaviours that he knew to do naturally but didn't understand he should be doing them to
her. Vulture. Did you feel a bit left out that he decided to move his affections onto one of his own kind?
No, not really. No, I mean, one of the goals for us is obviously to do the best that we can for the birds.
Uh-huh.
And so it's, you know, that pride of that achievement far outstrips any sort of like, oh, he's not interested in me anymore.
So one of the species that you're trying to rear here is the bearded vulture. And I know that unlike a lot of vultures, they produce 2 eggs often, not always, but often.
Yeah.
But also that the birds take part in a lovely pastime called canism, which is when the first hatched chick decides to push the second egg out of the nest.
In species that have canism in the way that they do, really the second egg is an insurance policy.
Sure.
The second egg is sort of only really there in case the first one doesn't hatch or something predates the nest and one of the eggs disappears or something like that. So what will happen is the first chick will hatch, and because the pair will incubate from laying the first egg, the second egg is laid a few days later.
Okay, so it's always going to hatch a few days later.
It's always going to hatch a few days later, which means the first chick has a size advantage over the second chick, and there's aggression between the chicks when they hatch. So if the second egg doesn't hatch...
Do they still hatch at the same time then?
No, they hatch.
So they don't really meet, do they? Or does he wait for the second one to hatch and then gives it hoof out the
and
nest?
Then will relentlessly beat it up until such times as... And sometimes it's not as much beating up as just out competing for food.
Sure, okay.
So you'll see chicks in the nest, and you think of a chick as being cute and fluffy and lovely, don't you? But actually there's an amazing amount of bullshiness and personality just between the chicks. So the older chick will just beat on the younger chick until it sort of cowers away. And then the older chick is going, thanks, I'll have the food, feed me. And parents are feeding whichever mouth is squeaking at it, you know, loudest.
The squeaky wheel gets the oil.
Exactly. So the canism comes about in that basically the older chick wins the fight the whole time and the smaller chick, the younger chick, doesn't really stand a chance. So in nature, that chick would never survive.
Sure.
But if you're running a breeding program and you
want to have a greater percentage of young chicks, take me through, in particular, your bearded vulture attack plan for creating new bearded vultures. So mummy bearded vulture lays 2 eggs.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do?
So what we would do is take the eggs, bring the eggs in for artificial incubation and leave her with dummy eggs. So she
carries them. So you take both on?
Potentially, yeah. Okay. Because it might be that one of the eggs isn't fertile. Occasionally it's not fertile. It might be. And you just don't know until you bring them in and look at them. So we do something called candling, where you shine a light through the egg.
Sure.
You get rid of the ambient light in the room and you can see through the shell and determine what's going on inside that egg, at what stage of development, how big the embryo is, if it's fertile at all, you know, if it's developing at all.
How long would the mother get to sit on the egg before you take it? How long do you give her before the wooden egg comes into her?
In an ideal world, a little bit of parental incubation is a great way to set the eggs up for success. Uh-huh. So I tend not to take eggs straight away from day one. Occasionally you have to. Something happens, the egg's not laid in the right place.
Sure.
Or, you know, occasionally you kind of, you have to intervene. But ideally I would leave the eggs for a little bit of parental incubation the first couple of weeks or so.
So you've candled, they're both healthy eggs. What happens?
Candle, both healthy eggs. Bring them all the way through to hatch. In the incubator room, so artificially incubate them. And again, they're going to hatch asynchronously. So the first one's going to hatch. The aim is always to get birds as soon as possible.
Yeah.
You know it's fit and healthy. Give it a head start of a few days in the incubator brooder room. Put it back in with parents. Now, what you've got with two chicks where you know they're going to fight if you put them together in the nest is you work your way around switching the chicks out. The parental instinct is so good that the majority of the time they're not going to go, you're not the same chick that was here 5 minutes ago, you're smaller, it's still a squeaking mouth to be fed. So the instinct of the parents is to feed whichever chick is in the nest.
Okay.
And what you can do is manage who's in the nest
and who's getting
and switch
what?
Them out. So one comes into the brooder room, gets fed by me for a day. One goes in the nest and gets fed by parents for a day. And then you swap them around until such times that one of them is big enough to keep itself warm.
Uh-huh.
And then you can set up a situation in the aviary where the chicks can't get to each other across two adjacent nests, but the parents are able to feed both chicks.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And once they reach a certain size, the instinct to fight with each other fades away. So once they get to, you know, halfway grown, three quarters way grown, they're not instinctively wanting to attack each other anymore.
They've like got humans past, when they're in their 20s, they finally got past that point.
You
where
suddenly realise your brother
quick.
Or sister is actually quite a cool person and, you know, you get on with them okay. So there are ways that you can manage it by, you know, putting up divisions, making sure parents can access both chicks, but chicks can't access each other, all of that sort of stuff. But it really, one of the things about incubation and eggs and rearing is that it's so individual and you have to be willing to be flexible and to change the plan.
You like to sleep on the floor in the room with the eggs for those final moments.
I do become quite obsessive about it, but it's because my theory is that as soon as I have touched that egg, if we've made a management decision that that egg is going to come into the incubator room, I'm now its parent from the point of view of it's my responsibility to give that egg every opportunity to hatch successfully.
Sure.
So, and the crucial moments really are, you know, right at the end, everything comes together and there's a really specific set of what the embryo, what the chick does, in what order to be able to successfully hatch. And everything from the tiniest hummingbird all the way up to the biggest eggs, you know, they all go through the same developmental stages within the egg. It's fascinating. I never get bored of eggs. They are so interesting.
Do you have a collection of shells from successful hatchings? Or?
A few, yeah. I haven't kept all of them because they're just gather dust. Yeah, but we have kept the condors. And I think I've got Bernadette's eggshell somewhere in a cupboard as well. It's...
And then I guess the next step is that at what age would you be looking to release a vulture? Does it matter?
It does matter, and it matters across different programs.
Sure.
So different release programs do things in different ways. The Bearded Vulture program have a very sort of, you know, they've got it down to a fine art. They have a very prescribed way of releasing their birds. And what they do is they take a chick that is 90 days, give or take, 90 days old. So it's not big enough to have fledged just yet, but it's near enough. It's a big chunky bird. It's just not quite at that age where it would fledge. And they take it and they put it into a nest in the wild, where they continue to provide food,
sure,
as the parents would, and that chick then will fledge from that nest
as naturally,
out, as naturally as possible. Yeah. So they have to go through all of the learning and things that they would do, flapping on the edge of the nest, uh-huh, learning to fly, taking off, getting themselves back to the nest, all of that sort of stuff in the wild.
But that's a pretty quick turnaround for you. You've got 90 days from hatching to get it out to Africa to get it going.
Yes. Yeah, well, the releases are very well organised by Alex, who runs the stud book and the VCF Bearded Vulture release sort of schedule. He's very busy at that time of year.
I can imagine.
He's orchestrating.
How many
he's
people
the
are
master.
Breeding bearded vultures in this country, first off, but...
In this country, as part of the breeding program, I believe we're the only ones.
Okay. Internationally?
Internationally, it's quite an extensive breeding program. Off the top of my head, I can't tell you
exactly
how many.
Because it's been around a while and it's sort of got its legs.
Yeah, it's been very well established. When it comes to birds like the Egyptian vultures, for example, mm-hmm, that's a whole different sort of set of parameters and things that we do, again, because it's a different species. It behaves in a different way.
Sure. They're a lot smaller, about a third of the size.
Yeah, they're a lot smaller. And they're also migratory. So the way they move around, they spend their time in Europe and then they move down into parts of Africa, parts of Asia. There's a few different flyways depending on where you are. So the European Life Programme for the Egyptian vultures has done a lot of research into the best ways to release. And what they've found is that if you release them as early as the Bearded Vulture Programme does, they actually don't stand as good a chance of survival because they have to be fit and ready and able to migrate.
Okay.
And so because they're not, you know, learning from parents and fledging out into
an area,
they're slower to learn things, which if you're not migratory doesn't necessarily matter. As long as there's food supply, you can learn things at your own pace. But if you're migratory and you're under that seasonal pressure that you need to get your ass into gear and get moving by a certain point, they don't know where they're going or how to make it or have the fitness. So with the Egyptian vultures, they've actually realized that letting them go for release later, uh-huh, after they've done their first winter, then go for release, they're fitter, they're more capable, they have a better understanding of the world, and they can follow the adults and work out where they need to be going for migration.
Amazing.
Neville. You haven't fed me yet. No, and I'm walking past with bones.
The audacity to walk past with food that's not for him.
Off I go. It's here.
She, yes?
She, yeah, no carrunkle. So a boy without a carrunkle is a girl. And this is a four-year-old, so.
What would she do if I went in there?
She'd get extremely excited, be very happy to play with you. And just because they're so strong, etc., you'd probably end up with a tear in your clothing or something just because she got overexcited.
Sure.
She's probably the best candidate we have for the ongoing breeding project with them. She loves other condors. She thinks other condors are amazing to play with.
At what point would you consider introducing her to a male?
A male, not till much, much later. You could introduce her to a male if he was younger. What you wouldn't do is introduce her to an older male who's potentially
going to just dominate and...
Well, who gets into breeding condition before she does.
Sure, okay.
So what you don't want is a female who is maybe 8 years old, still 2 or 3 years away from breeding, and you have a male who comes in who, because he will just batter. He will be very aggressive with her. He'll push her around. And that's where you start getting injuries and problems. You're in a cage environment. They don't have the opportunity to necessarily escape and run away and go mm-hmm. somewhere else because they're in problems. So you have to make sure that you don't create these artificial situations.
She's getting into that bony bit of
yeah.
the cartilage bit.
She's going for the spinal cord. That's what she really wants to get to. So she's breaking between the vertebrae to get to the spinal cord. That's when you start seeing the real strength in them.
Yeah.
And you can see that using her foot to hold it down
yeah,
and her
not,
legs.
Not gripping.
To,
she's not gripping it.
No,
she's just
using
her weight to keep
it
in place.
And using her body weight.
Unlike eagles and a lot of other birds of prey, these guys have a huge amount of power in their necks. They're used in rituals in South America. They have a thing called Yule, which is a festival, blood festival. And they tie condors to bulls and then they fight the bulls. It's wrong in so many different ways, but...
They tie the condors to bulls to aggravate the bulls?
So no. It's to do with the whole conquistador come local. Uh-huh. So it's to do with good and evil fighting, etc. But about 20-25% of the birds die, not necessarily directly from the injuries sustained, but maybe through broken wings, sure, or non-recoverable injuries. The amazing thing is that any of them survive.
Yeah.
It tells you how tough these birds really are. They're sewn onto the back of these bulls. The bull is then fought. Bull falls over. Condor Rosa, gets squashed. Yeah. It is an amazingly tough animal.
And yet, therefore, it's amazing that human impact has had such a detrimental effect
that's probably population. As much to do with the fact you only get one egg every 2 to 3 years.
They can't replace what's lost.
Yeah, so your reproductive cycle is incredibly short.
Should we go and feed the beardies?
Yeah, let's go and do the beardies. Come down and get my bucket. Hi, you two.
They're sunbathing, aren't they?
They're just chilling. She's on the right, he's on the left.
The beard is a bit comical, isn't it?
It's a goatee.
Was that wingspan about 3.5?
No.
Not quite?
No. Yeah, you're probably 7 foot, so 2 and a bit.
Uh-huh.
She's parading around with her bit of bone up there. There we go, down it goes.
Do they throw up the vomit when they get want to take off? That's an escape plan, isn't it? Is that all vultures?
Yeah, a lot of vultures have their fight or flight response is if they've eaten, but they feel threatened and they need to fly away, they will
vomit to lose weight.
You know,
well, also gives a food for your potential threat to come and eat rather than you.
Well, not if it's got a pH of 1.
Well, you know.
It smells lovely.
I bet it does.
Have they smelt or seen the feeding?
Looking.
Because old world vultures are sight, aren't they?
Yes, the old world vultures primarily tend to seek things out by looking for it, whereas the new world vultures, particularly the turkey vulture,
got a really good sense of smell.
Has a really good sense of smell. And they like their food as fresh as possible.
Turkey vultures about 1.5 hours.
Yeah, contrary to popular belief, where people say, "Oh, they're eating rotting carcasses that have been lying around." As long as it's been dead for 1 hour or so to start giving off the scent that a live thing doesn't, they can detect it.
Interestingly, the sight thing in the old world vultures is where the smoking the brains of a vulture allows you to foretell the future. The thought is, how do the vultures know there's a dead body there?
Sure.
So they obviously know there's going to be a dead body, which is why there are so many of them there.
So what's the next step, I guess, for the Horseman Trust? Like, what do you want to achieve moving forward? More of the same?
We are continuing the research that we're doing into vultures, whether it be the genetics work or the work we're doing with the behaviour, trying to improve life for vultures generally in captivity. 2024 for us is really going to be the focus on looking at the populations, not just here but also around Europe. Ultimately, long term, we're looking at trying to have more student placements and internships. And we'd like to be having people coming in from the countries we actually work in and support, so that we can be training and teaching in the UK people who will then be going back and carrying out the work in situ.
To end on, what is your most wild vulture encounter?
Oh, it's a tricky question. There are moments with our birds that we have the closeness and the relationship with them that you don't get with the wild. So I will never forget having my coat used as a towel to dry the muddy face of a vulture who just decided she was going to rub her face all over. I was filthy by the end of it. But she'd been having the best fun in a muddy puddle. And it's those moments that drive our passion for what we're doing here, as well as giving, you know, the ones in the wild the leg up that they need and the future that they need.
I was going to say, actually, adding to that, one of the greatest moments is when you get a bird back to a country where it's either going for release or it's going into something where it will be producing offspring for release. We shipped a lappet-faced vulture back to Israel 1 year or so ago. It was a very long story. It took a very, very long time. Everybody was involved. Everyone was amazing, from Border Force through to APHA, the whole lot. And to see a bird who'd, not through any of its own faults, had ended up in a rescue centre in Europe, finally getting to somewhere where he was partnered up with another bird and was fulfilling what he'd always wanted to do, was tremendous. And, you know, that's an incredible feeling. There's nothing to beat actually achieving something and feeling like you've succeeded where a lot of things haven't happened for that animal.
Perfect. Thank you very much indeed. I've had a wonderful visit.
I spent a wonderful couple of days with Holly and Adam and their incredible birds, and cannot commend their work highly enough. It's certainly an uphill struggle, and as Adam said, they're at the very start of a centuries-long project, but I wish them all the very best and cannot thank them enough for sharing their time with me to show me around their Welsh home. If you would like to know more, then head along to their website, vultures.ngo, or hunt down the Trust on the regular social media channels, or indeed, head along to our website, treesacrowd.fm, where you can read a short blog of mine following the visit. But until next time, thank you very much for listening. Bye-bye for now.
Oh, the oak and the ivy, oh, the oak and the ivy, oh.
This podcast is produced by OG Podcasts. Find out more at ogpodcasts.co.uk.